Before we dive into the episode, make sure you hit subscribe on the podcast platform you're listening on. Also, follow me on X at The Dave Dynasty and subscribe on YouTube by looking up Nostalgic Dave Dynasty. You can also buy one of my shirts at ProWrestlingTees.com/TheDaveDynasty. Now, enjoy the show.
Welcome to 1 hour of the toughest, roughest wrestling you'll ever see.
That's right, Dick the Bruiser, set it off.
The big question, have you got the endurance? Have you got the brains to get past the excellence of execution?
The reason why Axe and myself were put on this earth is to demolish people.
Bobby Heenan is a very good-looking sport coat you've got on.
Yeah, and I paid for mine. Mine isn't government issue.
Yellow, everybody. Lance Russell and Dave Brown right along ringside. By golly, we're ready to go with another big week of championship wrestling.
Greetings, wrestling fans, and welcome to Wrestling Nostalgia. I am your host, Dave Dynasty. Joining me on this episode is my guest, Travis Orndorff, the son of Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. Now, Paul's birth date was October 29th, so I wanted to have Travis on remembering his father and his career. So that discussion is coming up soon. Last episode, I had drill instructor Bob Carter on, and many of you listeners weren't familiar with who Bob is. But however, the feedback was great. And most of you loved the stories Bob told and loved learning about his career and being introduced to him. That is one thing I like to do here on the show, right? I like to have some guests that have very, very, whatever you want to call it, very deep careers and lots of stories to tell that you might not be super familiar with. And I like to shine a little light and bring some attention to them because they are deserving. So I'm glad I was able to do that somewhat with Bob Carter last episode. Now, I recently posted on my social media my ballot for the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, so you can go there and check that out and see who I voted for. If you are also a voter and might be interested in discussing the voting on an episode, if I decide to do one, I'm not sure yet, please reach out to me and maybe we can discuss that. Now, I have had some people reach out to me and ask about the AWA and Stampede Deep Dive episodes. I apologize for not having any of those released in a bit. I've been super busy lately with work and live things, and it's really cut into my research time for those two shows. I do assure you that they are coming, and there will be new episodes coming out as soon as I can. So I appreciate your patience with that. So don't worry, they're coming. I'm sorry. So let's take a break. And when we come back, we will have our guest, Travis Orndorff. So stick around.
Hey guys, Ray Russell here, curator of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, inviting you guys to listen to many of the programs here as part of the WrestleCopia brand, including, but not limited to, the Wrestling Memory Grenade, currently covering the 1988 and the WWF project. You can also listen to the Regional Wrestling Podcast, where we talk the territories, whether it's Jamie Ward with Georgia 81, Roman Gomez with the UWF in 1986, or Gene Jackson covering Memphis in 85. Three projects going on right now over there at Regional Wrestling. You can also listen to The Wrestling Stoop with the legend himself, Bob Roop. Bob goes back in time each and every week, covering not just his career, but countless stories and interactions with hundreds of wrestling names spanning his two decades in the business. But that's not all. You can also check out the Puro Wrestling Academy with the professor of Puro Resu, Mr. Dan Ginnity. Dan and I go back in time and cover the history of Japanese professional wrestling in the English language. And you can listen to all of those shows and more, all part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network, located over at WrestleCopia.com. That's WrestleCopia.com, and anywhere your podcast streaming needs are met, from Apple to Spotify, Pocket Cast, and beyond. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to our social media guys for all the latest goings on here at the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. Plus, I'm constantly adding old school video clips and pictures from throughout wrestling history. You can follow us over on X, formerly Twitter, at Wrestling Grenade. That's at R-A-S-S-L-I-N Grenade also. Follow and like me, Facebook.com/WrestlingGrenade. And why not subscribe to YouTube.com/WrestlingGrenade? So if you're looking to support that next up-and-coming podcast brand, please consider making it WrestleCopia.
This is Listen to Their Screams, a horror podcast that feels like you're chatting with friends. Hello, I am one of your friends, Dave. I am one of the co-hosts of Listen to Their Screams with my friend Ike, and we want you to come and check us out. We are a fun-filled, positive horror movie podcast that does reviews, news, birthdays, anniversaries. We play games. We are a ton of fun every week for you, the horror fan out there. For all of our links to our social media and the podcast platforms, just check out our link tree. It is linktr.ee/listen2screams. That is listen, the number two, and screams. Or look us up on your favorite social media platform and podcast provider. And welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. This time I'm being joined by the son of Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff. This is Travis Orndorff. Travis, how are you?
Man, I'm pretty good, Dave. I always tell people, I always have a good day, but I might have a bad moment, but not a bad day. How about you?
That's right. I'm good, too. I'm a positive guy, and something bad happens. I'm like, yeah, well, just take it in stride, move on, and it's all good. I got a lot of stuff to be happy for, so I can't complain.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I think gratitude is often discussed, but the actual practice of it can be difficult. There are studies done that neurologically, just talking about or writing down three things a day to be grateful for, can change your perspective. So I have religiously written down 10 things that I am grateful for every day since December of last year. And it keeps things in perspective all times. Right. Yep. And you know, inevitably as I go throughout my day, the more present I am and the more present I am, the more I'm in a position to be of service to people and help them through their day. Cause I think it's a struggle. I think life is a struggle, right? It's not easy. And the best we can do is to be a positive light to the people around us, like my father was.
Absolutely. Completely agree. And let's talk about your dad. And he had quite a football career, right? In college, got some looks in the NFL. Did he stay a football fan through his whole life?
So dad's funny about that. And so yes, he played football, you know, all through high school at Brandon High School, just in Hillsborough County, just outside Tampa. Yep. And he had scholarship offers to other places. Dad was a homebody. He didn't like being away from home, ironically choosing a career where he was always away from home, right? Yeah. But he did go locally to the University of Tampa. My mom had given birth to my brother, both of them at a young age. And so dad was, you know, he always told me he was a better baseball player than he was a football player, but football gave him opportunities that at the time baseball didn't. Yeah. So he did play football through college. He was drafted by the Saints. My understanding is he basically skipped out on his physical after they were doing some rookie hazing. Mm-hmm. And so he did, he played shortly in the USFL, which he didn't talk about much, but you know, dad wasn't home a lot. So for the opportunity to present itself that he would watch football didn't really pan out because he wasn't at home. So what did he do on the road? I couldn't tell you. He got older, you know, he absolutely would turn on the football game on a Saturday, specifically college football. We were always college football fans of both him and I. Or Miami Hurricanes fans. So we had that in common. Of course, I had to always be the one that bought him the shirts for Miami Hurricanes. but he was a college football fan. He would watch the NFL. He did like the Raiders and the Vikings, and not much of a Bucks fan, ironically. But I think Dad appreciated more than anything the athletic capacity, commitment, and dedication it took to play any of those sports. So, you know, I never saw him watch, you know, ice skating, but beyond that, track and field, you know, he would watch that if it was on. But more than anything, just to be honest, probably if he had the TV on, I would say probably 75% of the time it was a hunting show, which just so you know, if, because he'd say, come on up, I'm watching a show. And in my mind, I'm like, oh no. But it is the most boring thing. You like, they're whispering to a camera, yeah, right? And they're talking. And you know, I'm not a hunter. I'm more of a pacifist. And
yeah,
but
me too.
Not that I'm not a fan of the meat. I go do your thing. I'm fine with it. But yeah, you know, somebody's just whispering.
Yeah.
Like, damn. You're just like, this is insane. This is not entertainment. So I evidently require a different level of dopamine than he required.
Yeah, my dad used to watch fishing shows. I thought, what are you watching? What is, what's, you know, a guy sitting in a boat? Like, what? What are
you doing? Well, here's the thing, though. I think, you know, I'm 46, so my dad was born in 1949. You know, if you think about the way television evolved, he watched, you know, a lot of those older shows didn't have color and they didn't have a lot of flair, and so, you know, they weren't, you know, Dad wasn't much of a communication type person. So for me, like, I'd much rather watch a Dave Chappelle stand up that is so smart and funny, right?
Yeah.
You know, I watch the only time of year I have or pay for television is during college football season. And I know it's ridiculous because they're 18 to 20 years, 21 years old, but I have been a fan of Miami Hurricanes since I can remember watching television. So yeah, very, very early on, 4 or 5 years old, and I still get sick before the games. I don't it doesn't matter if we play Ball State. There's a little bit of anxiety in my body before they play.
There you go. Ball State. That's where my daughter-in-law went to school there in Indiana.
Oh, really?
Ball State. Yeah. And I'm a baseball. So your dad played baseball. Did he have a favorite baseball team?
No. That you know, I can't recall. And so you know, Dad, when he was home, you know, we went to church, we went to the gym, and he went hunting. That was kind of his routine. He had a, you know, garden at one point. We'd go out by the pool, but Dad was, again, he was a homebody. And so going to, I go to Braves games, and yep, so I'm a Braves fan and have been since I was a kid. And I'll go to maybe one or two a year, but I don't watch them on TV. That to me is like pulling teeth. But you know, I watch the Masters. So I guess golf has got to be worse than baseball. But no, yeah, you know, he never much talked about baseball, except to say, and I still have his glove from when he was in high school.
Oh.
And so something he kept. He kept his high school glove. It's green and it has the PPO burned into it and into the leather. And so Dad was absolutely a sports fan, but we never once went to an event.
Yeah.
And you know, and in most, other than every wrestling show you can imagine that was always packed, but he wasn't big on crowds, ironically. And so it was such, and this is going back a long time, right? Mm-hmm. But it would have been the majority of my, you know, youthful years from, say, you know, 4 years old to the time I was, you know, 14. Going to the Waffle House was an event.
I bet. You know,
going to the Cracker Barrel was an event. It would be mobs of people everywhere he went. And so, you know, nothing like you would see for, you know, certain famous people in today's day and age. But, you know, being a local celebrity in a small town in South Georgia, just south of the airport, it was, you know, I think he valued his privacy and his alone time, and he isolated. I think he needed to recharge his mental battery. Being around a lot of people, he was very much a one-on-one kind of guy. And so not much on baseball games, not much on events. We never went to a concert. I never sat in the crowd of a wrestling event until I was 23. I think I took some friends I worked with that wanted to go. Yeah. I took my son to a WWE event last October. Those are the only two times I've ever sat in a stadium watching wrestling. And so, you know, even during those years where we would be around events, I do remember one time he did love music. Right. And so Bob Seger was doing a test at the CNN at the Omni, and wrestling was going to be there. So we did go out and listen to them play doing their testing on the mics and the sound system. And, you know, that was a moment where Dad got to be alone, right? It's just me and him and we're watching this, and he's just absorbing it. And so, you know, he, this is just my opinion, because there's only so many things I could have discussed with him that I had a comprehension of, specifically mental health and his kind of background. I got pieces, and then I was piecing it together for many, many years later, right? I'm reading into it, studying it as much as I could. But my belief is Mr. Wonderful was always a persona that allowed him to not be Paul Orndorff. That was his way of exuding confidence, protecting his inner child. That was genuinely a different type of person than he really was at home. I think he had a little bit of social anxiety. I think he was with his friends, but we didn't have a lot of people come over. We weren't going to places with the wrestlers and their friends and the families. And that just wasn't our thing. I can count on my hand throughout the time that I was 18, 19 years old when Dad was really active. Because, you know, by the time I moved out in the late 90s, early 2000s, he had broken his neck, so he was no longer involved with wrestling. But I can only count on a few, maybe two hands, how many times he went to Rick Rude's house or we went to Steve Austin's house. It wasn't, he was a homebody and not a lot of people around. And he had his room and, you know, he had all his, you know, deer and boars and turkeys and all that stuff hanging on the wall.
Yeah. Well, let's we'll skim through his career a little bit. We're not going to go too detail here, but he was trained in Florida. And, you know, he worked in the NWA, went through Mid-Southern, Tri-State, a few territories. Won a few titles here and there. But in 78, kind of one of his first big things, right, he won the World Tag Titles with Jimmy Snuka. And held him for 5 months. And it's funny when you look at his career now, in a retrospect, he had a lot of success as a tag wrestler. Did he ever talk about did he enjoy tag team wrestling?
So I was born in 78.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And what I'll tell you, and it'll tie into it a little bit, I think, is Brian Blair was there when I was born. Yeah. And Brian and my dad, you know, got there a little bit late because they had been at a show, and they're tapping on the glass through there and Dad's like, is that one mine? And you know, because I was born, ironically, with a full head of hair and a full vocabulary, probably more importantly. And, you know, and so Brian's like, yeah, Paul, that's your child. And so, you know, what I will tell you from my own experience with my father, he, and this doesn't apply to Jimmy Snuka, but... Mm-hmm. When he did tag team with people, what I think he enjoyed more than anything was the opportunity to share what he had learned. And so in a solo match where you don't have control over that individual, you only control the outcome, I do believe Dad enjoyed the process of planning out spots, right? Yeah. But Paul Roma came to the house when he, you know, during Pretty Wonderful. Yep. And I got to observe those conversations. And even later when he went to the Hall of Fame, Chris Masters, right? Mm-hmm. He spent some time with him, and obviously he ran the power plant. So what I saw when he had these tag team matches is typically it was with people that were, you know, a little bit younger, a little more green, not as much, you know, experience. And I know he loved training people. And yeah. So when he talked about individuals like Jimmy Snuka or, you know, Big Cat Ernie Ladd, he had the utmost respect for them as wrestlers. But that camaraderie and that process of how to play out this and get the crowd involved, that was something I think he was extremely passionate about. And to get that opportunity for them to talk about, we'd be on the road and you know, I might be in the back seat in some cases, but we were on a bus, and just hearing them, and I got to do it too. He would talk to me when we were in the car sometimes about interviews he knew was coming up, because he already kind of knew who he was wrestling. And so we would just throw ideas of things to say during these interviews. And so that process, that his ability to think through and talk through those things, I think that's what he enjoyed. I think he enjoyed those relationships.
Yeah. And well, and then, okay, then he went through the Southwest, but he went to Mid-South, right? This is where he kind of had his first prominent run as a heel, right? He won the North American title there, whatever. Obviously, you know, later in his career, he did both face and heel, right? Switched several times. But predominantly, Paul Orndorff, that we know, was a heel. Did he enjoy portraying a heel more?
Absolutely.
I mean,
it's not even a discussion. Like, and I'm always surprised when people ask, and not in an interview, but just in general, because you can just see how much he enjoys it.
Yeah.
Right. So I think what you got to see, and I'll put it in both perspectives again, just for my own knowledge of his personality, of what he was like as a human being, and then getting to watch his matches and seeing it play out. When he was coming up and oh gosh, what was his name? The promoter, Bill Watts.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time where dad was perceived as not going to make it. And so Bill was like, if you don't show me something, you know, you're not going to be wrestling next week or whatever that looked like. And so dad went in there and did the one thing he knew how to do, which was be intense. And his facial expression, like he had a level of focus in those moments and that aggression. He had that energy that just, and it, you saw it inside the gym. You might see it in Atlanta traffic, and you saw it in the ring. So I think when he went out, and at the time he was still a babyface, he went in there just, you know, giving it everything he had on every single move. And then, you know, as you look throughout his career and he got to do that as a heel, it was much easier. It played well to his strengths. Because the baby face obviously wasn't going to do the aggressive thing. It wasn't going to, you know, do the cheating thing. You know, so I believe it absolutely allowed him to exercise the demons. What with all this kind of, you know, intensity and passion and energy and anger and frustration. I think it allowed him to let that out in an environment where you can't do that in public, right? Yeah. And so what's funny is dad had such a tender heart. And so he might say something mean and then feel guilty about it the next second, right? But with being a heel, he didn't have to apologize.
Yep.
And so I will tell you, and nobody wants to hear this in our society now, but dad really struggled. And this is in, you know, the early 80s. Dad really struggled with people that were overweight. It broke his heart because he had family members. He hated smoking and he hated, you know, sugar. Like, you know, I've jokingly said this, but it's not really a joke. We did not enjoy food very much when I was a kid. You know, it was grape nuts with milk and you doctored it up with the microwave, like to make them soft. Like that was kind of a standard meal. But you know, dad getting to be a heel and say stuff that he was kind of thinking, but didn't really, like, it was ridiculous also at the same time. Because I remember, you know, the video of him being with the woman in the weight room, right? And he's doing the scene and, you know, he's saying about how she argues. And, you know, some of that is obviously the exaggeration. But some of that is what he believed, too. Now, keep in mind, at that point in time, you know, 15% of the country was overweight versus today it's closer to 75 to 80%. And yeah. I won't get into that, but a lot of that is, you know, because of our USDA and our food companies and the food additives. But I think he looked at things, whether it be somebody with a disability, a learning disability, which he also, I believe, had, and somebody that was struggling, like he wanted to somehow motivate you to make those changes because he knew deep down you'd feel better. Yeah. He didn't know how to say it, you know. So being a heel allowed him to kind of let out all of that kind of negative energy that he kept to himself. And so he also believed, and this was obviously a sign of the times, heels were the ones that made the money. Mm-hmm. You know, the title didn't mean as much if you couldn't, you know, get over. So that was certainly in his mind, his way of being successful. Because when he went out as a babyface and was really intense, he didn't change his wrestling style. He just didn't say the mean stuff, right? You know, just he didn't, you know, kind of backed off from the shooing people away and the yelling at him about, you know, touching his robe. But I'm not joking that was not much of an exaggeration. Like when the robe was around the house and I went to go touch it, like, did you wash your hands? You know, so, and that would mean me moving it out of the way so I could sit at the dinner table because it was just sitting back.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned earlier, you have an older brother, Paul III, right? Because some people may not realize that your dad's a junior.
That's correct. And so funny story, also traumatic. So dad, obviously, Paul Parlett Orndorff Jr., my brother, Paul Parlett Orndorff III. My brother got into some trouble in Coweta County down here in Georgia. And so he's 10 years older than me. Uh-huh. And so I'm driving my dad's truck and helping a friend of mine move from one house to the next. We have a bunch of nice furniture in the bed of this truck. And we drive through this town my brother had gone on a chase with the police. And they run the vehicle registration and it's Paul Parlett Orndorff Jr. And in their mind, that was my brother. So I get pulled over like at gunpoint. I get out of me and my friend are getting arrested on the side of the road. They think we've stolen this stuff. And luckily his mom pulled up and was like, that is not that Orndorff, right? And so they just kind of jumped to these conclusions at first. And then obviously they're looking at my ID and they're piecing it together. I'm like, my dad's a junior. Like, so yeah, nobody knew that, including everybody. Like, I was 16 and I was going 9 miles over the speed limit. So I can tell you, I very rarely speed to this day.
Because of that, yeah.
Traumatic.
I bet. Well, in 83, your dad went to the WWF, and where he had a, you know, lengthy run, probably where he's obviously most known for. But when he first went there, he was placed with Roddy Piper, kind of as his manager. That had to be fun for your dad, because I mean, Roddy was pretty intense too. So I imagine your dad and Roddy, did they get along? Did they butt heads? Did he ever talk about Roddy?
Oh, no, he loved him. Adored him. He would, you know, dad was different when a camera came on because that Mr. Wonderful persona, the arrogance, you know, even some of the comments I heard him say in interviews throughout the years, you know, after he had retired and kind of, you know, making comments about either Hulk Hogan or, you know, some of the newer wrestlers, you know, or the newer wrestling and things. If you sat him down without a camera, his conversation sounded and looked different, you know, and I've said this before that I could be in the car with my father and he would kind of get worked up and I was, you know, he allowed me to do this. So know that I never as strong and as big as aggressive as my dad could be. I never once feared him, not once in my life. I never thought to myself, he's going to hurt me or he's going to spank me. He probably should have, but that's regards. So there would be times where he would get really angry and I would start laughing and he would start laughing too, because it would click. But you know, my mom would always tell me, like, you're the only one that gets away with that. You know that, right? And I'm like, I can't tell you the answer. So I never heard him say anything negative about Roddy on camera. But, you know, for him to use words to describe those relationships, that wasn't his forte. But he would talk about stories of times they spent together on the road, these intimate moments when your children are experiencing things. And so going from town to town, those guys are your family.
Yep.
And I think a lot of times when you see those, you know, backroom things, and not so much today, I don't know much about that, but back then, a lot of that was, you know, combination of ego, because you came from the territories, so you thought you still had to act that way to keep your spot. And so there was some internal combustion and competition. And I think that was something that Vince was happy to manifest. But he adored Roddy. He, and I don't know if he ever said it on camera, but I would be surprised if he didn't. He has always said he was the best talker in the history of wrestling and one of the best talkers in the history of entertainment.
Yeah.
And I so agree. He adored him. What I'll tell you was in conflict is Dad did not look at the only person, and I'm not comparing him by any stretch of the imagination as far as greatness and the two different sports. His mentality, the way he talked about every match, is similar to me to things Kobe Bryant said, like how intense he was, how every shot was a, why did I miss that, right? Dad had this intensity in wrestling and a respect for it, both for his competitor that he did not want to hurt, which is why nobody I have ever heard got hurt from him doing a pile driver. What I think he struggled with is a lot of the boys partied, right? Mm. A lot of the boys drank. That even, and I'm not saying Dad didn't do that. He absolutely did. But if you were to look at it on a scale, it was 1% of the time. Dad never went to the ring drunk, right? In fact, I don't recall ever knowing my dad to get drunk. Yeah. We didn't have alcohol around the house. He did like in his 60s and he'd have, you know, a few beers. But as far as getting even remotely inebriated was something I never experienced. And so whether it be Roddy or any of the other boys that partied a little more, I think he struggled with that. And he would hint to it because he would never say anything bad about them. But obviously we know Roddy had a wild side, you know, him and Rick have had some throwdowns in towns, and Dad never got kicked out of a bar. You know, Dad was never caught in a bar, to my knowledge. You know, the only time I ever knew him to go to a bar was when he was younger doing bare knuckle fighting outside the bar his dad was in. So yeah. Dad was very against alcohol and in any really amount. Even if he had one until he got older, even when he had one, you could see like he thought he was doing something negative to his body, and he perceived it that way. So boy, did he love Roddy. I mean, I think when I look back at the relationships he had with wrestlers, him and Rick Rude, there was a companionship. A friend of mine said this, and before that, the definition of the word comrade, and it is, I know that you know what I know. And him and Rick were very, very aligned. You know, his relationship with Steve Austin when he was still in Atlanta, I perceived it as very much a friendship, a you know, hunting, you know, buddy, but also there was a level of mentorship because Dad obviously being, you know, older, and Steve has spoken to that, I believe, and even in print. So when I look at those relationships, whether it be Roddy or even, you know, Hulk Hogan, who, you know, he always referred to him as Terry, there was a love for them that the only thing I can imagine it being like is a football dressing room. You know, the friendships that are on there, but they definitely went to war. They were together 300 plus days a year. So love them or hate them, they were your family.
Yeah. Well, your dad, I mean, he was always in, especially that time, he's always in that main event mix, right? And that helped lead him, right? We talked about Roddy. He teamed with Roddy to face Hulk Hogan and Mr. T in the main event at the first WrestleMania. Now, I'm sure back then, probably for Paul, it was just probably another night at the office, right? Whatever. But yeah, when he got older. No, you don't think so? Not even then, back then?
I'm positive it wasn't. I talked to him about it.
Well, so, well, I wondered if I was going to ask if later he appreciated the magnificence of that moment. I mean, being in the first WrestleMania main event. See, a lot of guys don't recognize it when they're in it sometimes, right? So you think
what I'll tell you is, this is, I probably shouldn't share this, but I'm going to, because it's the truth. They knew that this was going to change the world.
Yep.
Dad said he could not recall a time in his life where he was so nervous and so anxious about an event. And dad played it. If you go back to his time in Tampa in 1969, University of Tampa played FAMU, which is the first unsegregated football game or Division I football game between, you know, against a historically black college.
Yeah.
And dad remembered the tension and he spoke to it. He said they knew, like, there was such a buildup. If you go back, and it's almost hard to find some of this footage and lay it out, because these things played out very slow.
Yeah.
You didn't see them Monday night, Thursday night. You know, you might see them once a week, and that depended on where you lived. And, you know, so there was this buildup to that moment that dad said all of them were freaking out a little bit. And, you know, even prior to entering the ring, I will tell you, there were substances involved because of the level of anxiety. They knew how big this was going to be. You got to remember, you know, while it may not mean nothing today to say the name Liberace, but back in 1984, that dude owned Vegas.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
And absolutely. You had the greatest entertainer and professional boxer and talker as Muhammad Ali.
Yep.
And the admiration those guys had for Muhammad Ali, like, you're walking out and he's part of the show, right? Like, he's part of this event. And so the admiration they had for Muhammad Ali, you know, you had Cyndi Lauper. This place was packed with celebrities.
Yeah, and Mr. T was probably the biggest, one of the biggest celebrities in the world at that time.
And yet he was the only one they were mad was there.
I know. What was that?
Because he wasn't a wrestler. They earned their stripes to get into a ring, and all he did was do a couple TV shows.
Yeah. So I was going to ask you that. Did your dad, was he a little disgruntled about Mr. T being in that tag match?
Absolutely.
Because you've heard Piper said it many times over the years. So.
Here, you got to understand that celebrities coming into wrestling now is not the same as it was where those guys were making 10 bucks a night and spending that on gas to get to the next show so that they kept a job, so that they made enough money on Saturday to pay for their trailer rent. Like, we weren't wealthy for many, many years. We were poor. We lived in apartments. We didn't have a house. Like, so you take somebody that was the culmination of their careers. You know, I'm not saying Hulk Hogan didn't have different moments, but the first one, that first moment is always the one that's hard to forget, that you're always trying to imitate in another event.
Yep.
And so while WrestleMania 3 was big for a lot of fans, it wasn't the same as the first night. And again, nothing against, I respect everybody's, that was your emotional attachment to that moment. So what you're celebrating is this great event, like, but that was their third time.
Yep.
So, you know, anything you do for the first time is always the thing that you're always going to chase. And so when you put together all these celebrities and all the eyes on it, and I think even, you know, Vince you know, convincing these guys, this is whether or not you guys make six-figure salaries the rest of your life, right? And yep. So there was a lot of pressure. One, you know, Dad said, you know, with Mr. T, it wasn't anything personal against him. They had just gone down this tough road in Japan, in these small towns in Louisiana, night after night, and he walked in off the street and was a major player. That was a struggle for them. Yeah. Vince is a genius for doing it, but because it really did bridge gaps. But for them, that was sacrilegious, because that ring was their church.
Yeah. Well, what about you? Because at this time, you're about 7 years old or so. Were you a Mr. T fan?
I wasn't an A-team kind of guy. That wasn't, you know.
I was saying, did dad come home and say, hey, no more A-team in this house?
No. Dad, those conversations, you know, obviously I heard them throughout the years. And so as I got older, I got to ask more exploring and narrowing questions, if you will. So I got to get past kind of the surface, and I'd be like, Dad, I know that's what you're supposed to say. What'd you really think of him? And he's like, oh, he's a really nice guy. And I'm just sitting there and I'm like, oh, because kayfabe never stopped for them ever.
Yeah.
Especially when a camera came on, they're back in that mode. And if you played the same character in a movie for 30 years, it would be hard to break out of that, you know, and there's actors that do it for a year and go crazy. So I think there was a level of respect for that, in the sense that the celebrity part of it, but he did not earn the stripes they did. And so there was a struggle, I think, emotionally, but I think they also accepted it because they knew that added an element and ultimately led to a lot of money.
Yeah. Well, what about for you, right? Again, 7, 8, whatever years old, being young, your dad's on TV wrestling Hulk Hogan, the most popular guy in wrestling, your dad probably at that time, him and Piper, the most hated heels. What's it like being the son of that heel and going to school and dealing with other kids who are Hulkamaniacs? What's that like for you?
So it was different for my brother than it was for me, because my brother was 16 and he was in high school, and there were people that wanted to pick a fight. There was, I believe it, because I carried this burden too, I think I just carried it differently. There was an expectation that you were tough. There was an expectation, this is the 80s. So, you know, misogynistic, egotistical was just the standard. Yep. And, you know, it just, they wore jams and Z Cavaricci. But, so I think for my brother, it was really difficult, because I think there was an expectation for him to, you know, either they didn't like him because of my dad, or, you know, they were willing to bow up because of my dad. For me, my dad was very protective. And it's funny because I feel like I know the most about dad, but during those years, I was in a very small private school.
Okay.
You know, it was a Montessori school. Yeah. And so, as you can imagine, these teachers and these kids and these parents, they didn't really watch wrestling. They were, you know, aviation engineers and and, you know, they were intellects. And so Dad had the foresight at that time that, now that, you know, he had started to make money, that I was put in private school, and that protected me so much from, I think, a lot of those things that I would have experienced in a public school, you know, in the town I lived in. So my class had like 10 people, you know, I think I skipped second grade. And so, you know, I did not have the level of exposure to that world and that fandom that I would have seen inside of a public school. Now, what I will say is, when I played baseball for the county, I did catch some of that, you know, from the opposing kids, you know, from the kids on my team, you know, a little bit. The parents were the ones, specifically the fathers, that would make comments about, I mean, I can remember people saying really horrible things about my dad. Yeah. And you know, at the time, you know, I didn't process it and take it personal. But I will say, I can't speak to what other people feel like, but I really struggled throughout most of my life walking into a room and not feeling like I had to perform. And it started very young because, you know, people would ask questions and pull you aside. And so throughout my life, specifically through my high school years, I think I kept up kayfabe myself. I know I did. And it was a struggle for me later because I felt like there was this expectation for me to be Mr. Wonderful's son. And so that was very much a part of my identity that I knew you would like this. But to be honest with you, Dave, most rooms I walked in, I felt very alone.
Yeah. Well, and another name that your dad's very closely associated with is Bobby Heenan. What'd your dad think of Bobby? Because to me, Bobby is the absolute greatest professional wrestling personality of all time. And I grew up in Indiana where Bobby got his start and got to see him work with Dick the Bruiser and things like that, you know, stuff of that. And, but Bobby, so quick-witted and everything else. So what did your dad think of Bobby?
So one, I lived in Carmel, Indiana for a period
of time. Oh, yeah. Well, there you go.
So for 4 years, I absolutely loved it there until when I came.
And yeah, me too.
Yeah. So the thing about Bobby, and I think this is often, you know, maybe because I was behind the scenes and it's the only version I got to see most times, I don't think people realized how much everybody loved him. I mean everybody. There was a level of respect and admiration. He very often would give advice. You know, a lot of those matches, people would go to him to talk through those matches. People know him as the manager. And so that is, in their mind, a gimmick. No, not at all. He actually was a manager. And he guided those guys through that. He brought out of them an element of commitment and confidence, right? Because Bobby was always committed to getting them over. Bobby never put himself over. If you really go back and watch anything, you look at some of the interviews he did, Bobby never talked about Bobby, really, right? Yep. And so even when him and Dad were going at it, it was because Bobby was siding with Rick Rude and he was putting over Rick Rude in front of Dad, and Dad would get upset. So I think people will never realize the admiration people had inside of that industry for Bobby Heenan. On a personal level, he did some horrible things to me as jokes as a kid, which, you know, they were funny, but people forgot I was 8 years old. It didn't matter, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But I got to spend some time with Bobby on two separate occasions, extended period of time. And during WrestleMania 30, the one my dad was in the Hall of Fame. Way back when. So during that entire event, Bobby and I were sitting in a chair in the back, you know, in the green room, if you will, and we didn't watch a single thing. He sat and talked to me about his daughter. He talked to me about Dad and different stories that was so funny. Because remember, back then, YouTube wasn't around. So there's stories that have come out later in the last few years about Dad ripping the steering wheel off the car. And so Dad would tell me of all the guys that ripped, Bobby was the worst. And Dad knew how, Bobby knew how to get on and poke him. And so there was this time Dad ripped the steering wheel off the car because he missed an exit. And Bobby was like, well, Paul, you know, he knew my dad would freak out and just started hammering him. And Dad, so Bobby was such a kind-hearted human being. He was a mentor to so many people. And I think you say manager. I could be wrong. I don't know this. But I don't know of any other manager that had the level of influence on wrestlers behind the scenes and their matches and allowed and brought them attention and put himself behind them the way that Bobby did. I believe wholeheartedly and with all due respect, all the other wrestlers and managers, Bobby was number one, hilarious. He was absolutely respected. He had done his time. He had been in a ring. Yep. And so he by the actual definition of the word manager, not the title of wrestling. He is the best manager to have ever set foot in wrestling, period.
Yeah, I agree completely. I don't know if you find too many people to argue that, but anyway, but your dad then, right? Your dad had this period, right, where he turned face, but then he turned heel again, and he had that really big feud with Hogan around 1986, right? One of the top drawing feuds of all time. And people, they think about things, right? They forget, right? That Toronto, 76,000 plus fans in Toronto to see those two wrestle. Of course, the cage match on Saturday night's main event that everybody talks about, right? And everything else. Your dad with Hulk Hogan, right? But again, a face is only as good as his heel, right? And Paul was Hogan's heel. Your dad made a lot of money for the WWF during this time. Your dad, I mean, he had to been, I mean, you talked about how you had a pride and a nervousness about WrestleMania. He had to been on top of the world this time with what they were doing.
Well, what I'll tell you is I remember, and it's funny that because I heard those stories from people, because I didn't watch those shows, like, would you watch your dad do his job?
No.
Right? Like, that doesn't, like, when you think about it, it's like, I didn't watch my dad's matches. That was what he, like, that's how I go to school. Like, I don't care. Like, you know, I just never was involved in it that way. But I got the opportunity because of situations like this throughout my life. And I'm very, very, very blessed to have had this opportunity. In fact, I'll tell you, I was at a gala on Saturday, and this will tie in to this, but it peels back a little bit of a layer. So I'm at this gala, and the gala, it's a 50th anniversary for the Worldwide Discipleship Association. And it's this, okay, you know, association that writes materials for, you know, it's a faith-based, you know, how to follow Jesus. And then, but they're in like 70 countries, right? And 30 languages. So I go in, and they mistakenly sat me at table one. I could not, but I don't know why I'm there. And I'm sitting there with some people, you know, the people that are with Chick-fil-A and my mentor from my childhood. And I'm sitting next to this guy named Akeem. And I don't know it at the time, but Akeem, I did know he was Nigerian, but Akeem was one of the speakers that night.
Okay.
And so I sit down next to Akeem, and I introduce myself, and I'm looking around this table. I'm like, I don't know why I'm here. Like, this must be a mistake. But my mentor, Hugh Kirby and Marilyn Kirby, had invited me down. And so they think more highly of me than they should. I'm sitting there with Akeem, and I introduce myself. And I said, Travis Orndorff. And he goes, Orndorff. And this guy, like, we just talked about his heritage, and this is kind of like we talked a little bit before I introduced myself. And he's like, Mr. Wonderful? And I'm like, what? And so this guy's speaking from Nigeria about the Worldwide Discipleship Association, and he's talking about World Wrestling Entertainment. And it's that moment when I'm like, wow, I forget how worldwide, like, World Wrestling Entertainment is a valid title.
Yeah.
You call yourself the world champs in basketball, but you're not playing the world, right?
Yep.
Like,
yep.
But World Wrestling Entertainment is truly worldwide. This guy from Nigeria that is a disciple of Jesus Christ that helps people, like, learn how to make shoes so that they can have income, knows my dad, right? That's the weirdness of my life.
Yeah.
Right. And so what I would say is, as I got older and having that opportunity to sit with this pastor named Akeem from Nigeria, who knows my dad, who says, I need a picture with you. My kids are not going to believe I met a wrestler's son because they love wrestling.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, wow, what a crazy life I've had the opportunity to live, right? So when I had the opportunity to talk to my dad about Toronto, it was from conversations like with Akeem where they're like, I remember this. And so yeah. I would go home and I would say, Dad, what was that like? Because I had an idea of how big it was, but you have to know I'm desensitized to it at this point too.
Right,
you know,
yeah.
That's just a Thursday. Like, that may be a big event for you, but that was my baseball game the next day. Like, it didn't have the impact. But I remember asking my father specifically about Toronto, right? The nervousness after WrestleMania, that was the peak for them, because once you got it going, all you had to do was not screw it up.
Yeah.
But when he did the Toronto event, I said, Dad, and this is all I asked him, I said, what was it like to walk out to 70 plus thousand people when you were expecting 12,000? He shook his head and he paused and he looked up at me from his chair and he goes, it's the greatest feeling ever. You can't replace it and you'll never understand it.
Yeah.
And that was it. And my dad didn't talk in those absolutes very often.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and I said, I think I said kind of like probably passive aggressively, like, well, what about when I was born? And he's like, I love you. That moment is irreplaceable. You'll never understand it. It's he couldn't put words to it. So I think what you got to remember, though, is that was a level of appreciation for the work he had put in, right?
Yeah.
Right. You know, I often use this saying in what I do, that, you know, as human beings and, you know, people in recovery and people that have dealt with trauma or whatever, you know, when we get those to these places in our life, we have an opportunity and a responsibility to bear fruit, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But we are in no way responsible for producing it, right?
Yeah.
So I think most people may work their entire lives. They may go and do the most unselfish things. You know, how often do you get to see the produce?
Right.
How often do you get to see that all that work you did culminated in the unfathomable five times of all? Like, you put your life and energy every day, with every meal, with every plane ride, with every time you drove in the car, with every football injury, with every time you wrestled hurt, with every concussion you got from getting slammed into the steel steps. Great idea, boys. You go through your entire life and you commit your entire life to this product and you get to see it play out and do something that nobody imagined. And so I think when you think about the pride of that moment, it was that moment when, man, all this work, this is what I got out of it.
Yeah.
And so knowing he was walking out to 70 plus thousand people that hate his guts. how often do you get to know you don't get recognition from your boss? Nobody does, right? Mm-hmm. You got to see the validation for how much they hated you. And you got to love it. And you got to go, I did a good job. Here's the result of all that hard work.
Absolutely. Definitely. Yeah. Around 98, right? Your dad kind of semi-retired. He had the arm injury thing, the nerve. He was running his bowling alley, right?
Was in 88.
Okay. Wait, whatever.
Yeah.
But what my question, though, leads to, there was that rumor going around, right? That Paul Orndorff's dead.
Oh, yeah. At that time.
Was your dad aware of that at the time? And what did he, I mean, did he chuckle at that?
So it was funny because Dad, you know, had his own room, right, where he would go watch those boring hunting shows. And then he'd be up there like doing, like practicing turkey calls. And it was like, you just shut the, I'm telling you, it was like, it's, you know, it's ironic that the World Wrestling Federation lost its name to the World Wildlife Federation. That's what really? It sounded like. I think my dad got the wrong WWFs.
Yeah.
And sounded like there was, you know, we were eventually going to be attacked by turkeys. And so, and forgive me, I got totally off track when I said that.
It's okay. We're talking about the Paul Orndorff is dead rumor.
Oh, yeah, the dead. Okay. So he's up in his room. And I can't remember who called, but he had a very close friend that was Greco-Roman wrestler and competed in the Olympics. Not, he didn't get to compete in the Olympics, but he had won one gold medal and something. His name was Brad Reagans. He was one of his hunting buddies up in Minnesota.
Yep.
And I think Brad was the one that called. And so Dad like answered the phone. And he's like, and I, you know, I was around. So I remember this happening. He, you know, he's like, Paul, you're alive? And Dad's like, what? Like, what are you talking about? And so, yeah, it was one of those moments when he, you know, I remember we, you know, we had this island in the kitchen. We all kind of just sat there all the time and talked. And he comes in and he's like, yeah, they think I'm dead, you know, and he just kind of go. And so we went about life. It wasn't, we all laughed about it. I was like, what? And, you know, why do they think you're dead? Like, you know, and so it was a chuckle. We all found it funny. I think my mom kind of wished he was, but the rest of us just laughed about it. And, you know, I think I recall like something along the lines of me saying like, well, what are you going to do? He's like, nothing. And then he went back upstairs and that was the end of it. You know, like he didn't pick up the phone and call people. What ended up happening is his phone started ringing off the hook because Brad's like, no, Paul's fine. And then everybody's calling to, you know, check in like it's a rumor. Right. So, you know, and you got to remember, this is before the internet. This is before, you know, all of the access. And so if something makes it into print, it stays in your memory for years. Yeah. I mean, there's so many things I know that I can bring up just from like a, you know, some of the things that people believe that they've heard years ago. And you're like, that's not true anymore. Like we debunk that, you know? And so I'll tell you, I don't think that ever really went away until he went to the Hall of Fame.
That
was low key. Like back then in the early 2000s, he was in a lot of pain and he had two neck surgeries and got his second through eighth vertebrae taken out. They put in cadaver vertebrae and a titanium rod. So that experience was really, really tough on him. And so before he went back out in the world, he spent time in recovery.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Definitely. Paul was definitely not dead. Right. He had, like you said, and he had a little bit of, you know, run after that, right? A couple of runs in WCW, Smoky Mountain, the UWF, right? He definitely worked after that. And, but then, it, you know, I think the injuries, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, right? The injuries just, it was too much, right? He had to, I mean, you said earlier he broke his neck.
Well, and, forgive me because I jumped forward in regards to that timeline of the rumor. I was more referring to what happened in his later years when he disappeared for a long time. Like that, even when he went back to wrestling, it still was kind of, you know, it came up anyway. So Dad, again, my opinion, but he did not want that surgery. Mm. And, you know, it's easy for us to forget where medical science was in 1980. I mean, you know, we didn't start having air conditioners till the mid 70s. You know, we've only had hot showers for 50 years. so to take on and have what would have been pretty unprecedented, not standard practice neck surgery. I remember when I got tattoos and my dad just hated them. And it's because he took so much pride in his body. Mm-hmm. And he would never have scarred his body with tattoos. I love my tattoos. My grandfather had his arms were covered in tattoos. And so as a kid, I'm like, I'm doing that. And I did. And so not knowing everybody would do it because it wasn't that big a deal when I started. But Dad having to do that surgery was not an option in his mind. And if I had to guess, the uncertainty of a career very much scared him. But I personally believe when he left the WWF, I think he left because he was hurt. I think he left because, you know, he missed his family. He wanted to be home. He thought he had found this opportunity in the Bowling Center. I think he was homesick. I think he was tired. But more than anything, I think he thought, again, just my personal opinion, knowing my father, and knowing, you know, what most people go through mentally when you injure yourself in the middle of your career, at the height of your career in many ways. Mm-hmm. I think he was more afraid of rejection. Mm. I think he was afraid that Vince wasn't going to use him. He wasn't going to be on top. I think that was hard for his ego. I think he was afraid of abandonment. He had experienced that personally in his life. He had some trauma in his life. So you play together. What made him great in his mind was his body. And yep. So if that wasn't there, who was he? Yep. You know, dad wasn't, you know, I dad was not the best talker on the microphone. You know, he had some hilarious moments. Like there were some times, but then there's times where he's talking about Ivan Putski and a turtle head. And I'm like, it's funny to go back and watch, but that's not great. You know, Mike's.
Yeah, yeah.
So dad had his moments, but overall that, you know, as you can tell in this hour, I'm the talker in the family, too much included. But dad did not know who Mr. Wonderful was with an injury. Yeah. And so I think fear, I think disappointment, I think knowing you did Toronto, knowing you had the Saturday night main event, and now you're going to walk around in his mind as somebody that had a limp right arm. And yeah. So I think he ran from that. And then when the Bowling Center didn't do as well as he had hoped, he went back into wrestling, which is the only thing he knew. And, you know, eventually, I think I was 18 when he had the first neck surgery. And, you know, that was, you know, it's over 12 years later than from when the original consultation was. And then, you know, he had the second one after that, which was, you know, after he got hurt in Buffalo. And so that was the end of that. And then ultimately, as he got older, he would have to grab his right hand with his left hand. And he was left-handed, so he's lucky. But he'd have to bring his hand to his mouth to use it. So, you know, in spite of that fusion he did, the nerve damage was done. And I don't know that there was a surgery to fix that. I don't think dad could imagine his life with a scar at that time. In fact, yeah. When he agreed to the surgery he had, that scar was like this big. That was it. And I think that's the reason he could accept it, because it wasn't, you know, going to be something that deformed his body. Whereas I have like scars all over my body, you know, from surgeries, and they're like, you know, I have 50 staples up at a chest on my right arm. And yeah. So in fact, when I was looking at buying dad's Mr. Wonderful persona, because I have a bad right arm and he did too, I named the company One Bad Arm.
Yeah.
You know, so in remembrance of him, and then also somehow I inherited it.
Yeah. Well, it, you know, it's funny because, you know, he didn't have to worry, right? People remember Paul Orndorff and the legacy. And one thing is, since he retired, right, he got a lot of recognition, the Hall of Fame, made a few appearances, got to do some fun stuff. But obviously, since his passing, right, you and your family, but a lot of it's you, have worked very hard keeping that legacy alive. And Paul Orndorff, as a personality, is very active on social media, and that you know that whole persona is out there, and live. So what's the best way for people to follow Paul Orndorff, the legacy, online right now?
So let me begin by saying that dad's legacy, I will give the credit to, one, the influence and the relationships and the emotional reactions and attachments to his career and some of the funny things he did, you know, people going back and watching the intensity of how he wrestled it, and it being really a unique style. You know, mm-hmm. I don't know. And dad was and ironically, even in spite of his body, he's one of the best tactical and technical wrestlers of all time too. Yep. You know, I think rankings are ridiculous. You're either good or you're not, but you know, dad was a, you know, if you go back, you see him do moves that you might not expect that were very, very nimble, you know, whether the leapfrogs that, you know, he had some, you know, I can't remember how far his broad jump was in Florida, but that record stood for many years. He had many records in track and field. So Tyler Ellenick, who reached out to me right after dad passed, and I had posted those photos of myself and my dad, as I, you know, obviously I didn't show the ones when he passed, but I held his hand till his very last breath. And so the lead up to that moment, you know, the level of grief and the loss of my own identity. I did not know who I was anymore. Like, I didn't, that was without a doubt. But if not for Tyler Ellenick, this legacy and these pages, they don't exist. So I want to make sure that we give him credit for everything that has happened. The as you can imagine, I do the comments because words are very fond of me. And so, but Mr. Wonderful Official, obviously on Instagram, Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff on X. And that's, and we have a small following on TikTok, that there's a few things there, but really Instagram and X are the main places that you can find that. And then obviously Mr. Wonderful Paul Orndorff on Mr. Wonderful on YouTube. So we have a YouTube channel. I'm not mistaken, we passed 3 million views, which, you know, statistically still only 1% of the country. So we're less than 1%. So everybody's like, there's a million people. I'm like, that's not that much. If you realize, like, 0.25% of the, you know, and then if we do 8 billion, then people are like, shut up. It's a lot of people. Right. And those are the places you'll find him. And we have all of his matches up that we've been able to locate. We have, you know, different family photos, obviously photos of myself. I was the prettiest one in the household, make no mistake. And I had this beautiful head of hair that he would not allow me to cut. And then obviously, you know, I end up, you know, bald, and I didn't even shave today. But, you know, what I would say is the legacy that we try to make sure is out there. Cause when Tyler, you know, came to me after my dad's passing, I was a basket case. You know, I needed to go to therapy, which I absolutely did for a while, right? You know, very intensive outpatient therapy because I was so depressed. But when he approached me, I didn't know how I felt about it. But my dad had always said, when prior to this, because that wasn't my thing, he's like, Travis, we got to do this thing on social media. And he didn't know much about it, but he wanted us to start something. Yeah. And so when Tyler asked, I was like, this is right. And so we started, it's obviously grown. I think we are sitting around, you know, 18,000 followers, but I am not motivated by any of that. What I am motivated by is the number of times I get these direct messages, because I do all the communication and comments, and I get that I used to paint my arms with green marker so that it looked like your dad's veins coming off his arm. And these guys are jacked, right? And I'm laughing because they're like, your dad's the reason I got into the gym. And I'm like, dude, you're jacked too. Like, you know, so the thing that is meaningful to me, it, beyond the followers, beyond the likes, it's the, hey, your dad pulled me aside and gave me an autograph. Or there was a story, one of the first fans, and I'll end with this, the first fans that I interacted with, what he was like, let me tell you a story about your dad. We were, you know, 15, 16 years old, and your dad snuck out of arena, and we were like, Mr. Wonderful, can we get your autograph? And dad was like, no, but I'll take you to eat. And so he took him to a pizza place, fed him, talked about working out, talked about their gym routine, talked about respecting their parents. And then ultimately, obviously, he signed an autograph for him. Yeah. But that describes my father better than any match ever will, because it's the passion. It was the love. He did it because he loved it. And what I'll end with is say, you know, when we started that and Tyler asked me to do it, it was for my dad. But it ended up being for me.
Yeah.
Because it was those people that helped me grieve and understand that, you know, his legacy is far beyond just being Mr. Wonderful's son. His legacy is one that I get to carry on in love and compassion and intensity and resilience and patience. And in humility. So, you know, it has allowed me to do things that I never imagined in the past year. And so the fact that I get to be a blessing in any way because he was my father, that is just wonderful.
No pun intended, right?
Absolutely intentional.
Absolutely intended, yeah. Well, thank you, Joe. And I got to thank you and your family, because I've interviewed a few children of wrestlers, and it's I can't imagine what it's like, but I have to thank you guys for sharing your father with us, right? There were times where, like you said, a lot of times where he was gone, he was on the road, and you didn't have that time with him, so that we could, right? That we could watch, so we could see, so we could experience. And so I thank you as a fan of your father for that, for your, sharing him with us, for sharing him with the world.
Thank you for sharing that. What I'll tell you is I hated you guys.
Nah, I bet. For
many years. Until it clicked that, I don't have anything without you. Like, you were not just my dad's fans. You were my school. You were the reason I got to eat. Like, I don't have the life that I've been honored to live without you guys. And so I think we just shared them together. And, when you get the opportunity, as I have, to see the impact he's had on other people, because make no mistake, my dad might not have been there, but he was always present.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. So, I thank you for giving me your time today to talk about him. I know, I can understand even after all these years, parts of it's, it's still going to be emotional, right? It's still going to.
Not a sociopath.
I would hope not.
I don't think. Well, people hate emotion. And yeah. I always go, if you're feeling something, just know what you aren't.
Yeah.
This may be hard to feel, but there is an alternative. And so, nobody makes you feel anything. You just feel it because you're a human being. And the best thing you can do is embrace those feelings and find out why they're there. And, the emotions that come with it, the grieving, that's just because of how much I loved him.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah. And I'll always be grateful for that.
Yeah, well, you should. And I appreciate you giving me time and talking to us about it. Hopefully everybody will go, if you don't already, and follow those social media outlets. You guys post some great stuff. I mean, it's some of it makes me chuckle. I know there are some recent things with Hulk Hogan, some things that came out, and there was just some funny things that, that were posted on the, made me chuckle. And it's your social media accounts are good follows. So hopefully if they don't follow already, my listeners will go and follow those. And help keep the spirit and the memory of Mr. Wonderful alive. The great thing is, I think his memory, it'll live forever, right? It's there. He's, what a career, what a life. And, I'm glad you got to talk to me about it and share some of your memories.
Thank you, Dave. I appreciate your time, my friend.
Hey, it's Bob Smith, and guess what? The Outdated Wrestling Hour is now part of the WrestleCopia Podcast Network. But hey, no fear, you're still going to hear the unique guests, comedy, music, authors, journalists, funny people. Who knows who's going to end up on the Outdated Wrestling Hour? Remember, it's all new and all old. So check it out in the WrestleCopia Podcast Network and wherever you get your podcasts. Listen if you know what's good for you.
Hey everybody, Gene Jackson here, inviting you to check out the Retro Wrestling Review, where each week I'm joined by some great co-hosts who help me review classic episodes of USWA Championship Wrestling, and right now we are doing week-by-week reviews of 1993. But we don't just do reviews, sometimes we get a chance to interview some of the people who were there and lived it, plus do watch-alongs. It's a lot of fun, so check out new episodes that drop every Wednesday at WrestleCopia.com. And to find links to everything associated to the podcast, you can go to uswapodcast.com.
All right, and welcome back to Wrestling Nostalgia. Thank you to Travis Orndorff for coming on and being my guest. Hopefully you enjoyed that interview. I am a huge fan of Paul Orndorff. Always loved him. And it was such an honor to talk to Travis about his father and about living with him, life with him, his career, everything else. Very, very cool to get to discuss all that with him. Guys, please make sure you go and follow me on X. I am at The Dave Dynasty. That is the best way to follow me on social media to see all the things I post, any news, announcements, etc. here for the podcast. But there are lots of pictures, videos, newspaper clippings, and everything else that I vote. While you're out there, also go check out all of the WrestleCopia network of podcasts. They're all very, very fun podcasts. Have a great host, great guests, great co-hosts. They shine a light on wrestling history. They're all just highly entertaining. And you're going to want to just listen to them all. Every one of them. You can look them up on your favorite podcast platform or go to WrestleCopia.com for more information, links to listen, etc. It's all right there. Also, be sure to go check out my friends at the Ultimate Classic Wrestling Library at ClassicWrestling.net, or you can download the app, the Ultimate Classic Wrestling app, on all of your devices. So go check them out. Now, on next week's episode, I will have guest Jerry Oates on the show. We talk about teaming with Jesse Ventura, training Marty Jannetty, teaming with his brother Ted, and much, much more. So be sure to subscribe so that you do not miss that episode. It was so much fun. Such a great interview. You're going to love it. Thank you to all of you listeners and supporters for all the downloads, follows, interactions, listens, everything else. You are truly great, and I really, really appreciate it. So that is it for this episode. So until next week when I have my interview with Jerry Oates, wherever you go and whatever you do, be good, be safe, and always keep on growing.
Fans, we've brought you All-Star Championship Wrestling. This is Sam Manager thanking you for being with us and saying until next time, so long, everyone.